Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Motormouth podcast, episode 3 with Tim Sylvie and myself, Harry Benjamin. In this episode, we chat to Perry McCarthy, a racing driver and the first ever Top Gear Stig. He chats all about the ups and downs of his career, from starting with severe back injury to cracking America before F1 came calling, but sadly, it wasn't meant to be. His fortunes revived after with spells in sports cars before the BBC came calling, and still with racing plans today. We hope you enjoy, and don't forget to like and subscribe. Just search for the Motormouth podcast in your favourite podcast platform, where you can also leave us a review.
So, welcome to the third episode of the Motormouth podcast. Harry, welcome back. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Tim. Good to be back on the next podcast.
So, what have you been up to? What's been happening?
Well, I did a very exciting voiceover this morning.
Did you know?
I'm not actually allowed to talk about it, but I'm going to anyway. But for a high brand super Italian supercar, who we're releasing a documentary in this year at some point. Which was a lot of fun.
Mysterious.
Very mysterious. What about you?
Not a great deal. My biggest news of the week is that my brother-in-law, who had a mention in the last podcast, twice in
actual fact. It's a recurring theme now.
Yes, he is currently, as we speak, in hospital with his wife who's having a baby. So Adam and Kirsten, best of luck. And by the time this is released, I expect they'll be at home wishing they'd never done it.
Well, this is the perfect present to give them, I think, for congratulations on a newborn baby.
It is indeed. Perhaps we should dedicate this podcast to Adam and Kirsten and their new baby.
I'm sure they'd be really happy with that, yeah.
So, listen, we've got another special guest with us today. A few key stats. He's aged 58, father to 3 girls, born in Stepney, East London. Started racing at a late age, into his 20s, where... until then, he was working for his father's company, servicing North Sea oil rigs. Has unfortunately got the tag as the world's unluckiest racing driver. Worked his way up through junior categories in Europe, Formula Ford, Formula 3, F3000, IMSA prototypes in the States, and many more. He's found himself testing for the Williams F1 team, Arrows and Benetton during the 1990s, and made his bow in Formula 1 in 1992 with a lesser-known Italian team, Andrea Moda, formerly the Collini F1 team, founded by an Italian shoe designer called Andrea Sassetti. In 2002, he released his autobiography, Flat Out, Flat Broke, which, of course, you can purchase on your Kindle. 2002 to 2003, he was the infamous Stig, the very first Stig on BBC's Top Gear, the Black Stig. And now plies his trade as a corporate and after-dinner speaker, working for brands all around the world, and has obviously appeared on numerous television channels, BBC, NBC, Radio 1, Radio 4, Top Gear, Women's Hour, Sky News, the list goes on. Perry McCarthy, pleasure to have you. How are you?
Yeah, no, good. Tails up and wagging. I'm looking at a couple of things that's really got me excited. So, yeah, just trying to make everything happen and actually return to the track. It seems as if I've not had enough of quite a long layoff. As in, like, 15 years. Yeah. I've decided, no, it's time to come back. And, I'm really, really champing at the bit.
Going back racing?
Yeah.
Is this out there? Do people know about this yet? Have we gotten a little exclusive?
No, well, I was going to say, we just chatted before and I was like, wait, did he say that earlier and I missed
this
it?
This is exclusive.
That is exciting.
I just can't, because it's down to the championship themselves to make the announcement, I actually can't tell you.
Oh,
could you give us any clues?
So
any hints?
It's got four wheels.
Has it got a tin top on it? Or
It has.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Let me give you a clue. It's not the British Touring Car Championship.
Oh, okay.
No, it's something that is dynamite. And this is going to be mega.
So anyway, when are we going to hear?
Yeah, do we have a date?
Ooh, do you know, funny enough, in about 3 hours' time I can announce it, but it's going to be just after the interview.
Oh, that's so disappointing.
I'm joking.
Jesus, like that. Oh, no.
It's probably inside about next week, I think they're going to announce it. So it's, that's great.
Exciting. It's all going.
Yeah.
So Perry, let's go back to the start. So as I said in your intro, you were fairly late to motorsport, starting at 20 years old. Before that, working for your father, what drew you into motorsport? How did you get down from working for your father on North Sea oil rigs through to becoming a racing driver?
It was a complete fluke. It really was. I was at college, studying law, economics, art. And a pal of mine there used to bring in these fantastic magazines, Grand Prix International, and they had these wonderful photographs. And I used to really enjoy drawing and drawing portraits predominantly. But I started drawing these cars. And the more I was drawing them, the more I was reading about the races, the more I was reading about the racing drivers. And I thought, these guys sound really cool. And at the same time, I found that driving on the road was something that I really enjoyed doing, because I was rubbish at football, cricket, rugby and all that. I really tried, but I just wasn't very good at it. But on the road, I found that, I could do some things with a car, and people used to enjoy coming out for a ride with me. And the police used to enjoy having a chat with me on the roadside as well. So,
did you pick up lots of points in your younger days?
Yeah, they said try and hold the car on an opposite lot. You mean those kind of points, yeah?
Yeah.
No.
So
I haven't got any points on my license. My wife's got loads, but I'm fine.
You've passed them across to her, haven't you? You can do that these days.
You can't do that. It's only a gag.
What were you driving
those days? A Ford 1.1 Escort. Ooh. Yeah. But it did have extended wheel nuts, and I sprayed the wheels silver. And I reckon that got us another 2 miles.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Easy.
Yeah,
it's maybe. So, no, it was a pile of junk. I mean, it cost £90, and £90 was cheap even back then.
Yeah.
But it got me out on the road. And one day, I play a bit of piano. So one day I was demonstrating piano in a pal's music shop. And this old boy came in, and I didn't realise it had been a setup. And he said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a Formula One racing driver. And he was the chief instructor at Brands Hatch, and my mate had set it up. And he said, you're coming with me. So he took me to Brands. I took him around the track. And that was it. He was kind enough to say I was the best he'd ever seen.
Wow.
Well, he only started yesterday, but yeah. So I thought, okay, well, that sounds cool. And then he introduced me to the circuit owners and made some phone calls. And then it basically came down that you had the rude awakening pretty quickly.
Yeah.
That if you want to go motor racing, somebody's got to be paying for it.
Yeah.
So that's when I took opportunity of going to work on the North Sea oil rigs.
Right.
And I stayed out there for 2 years, coming back, finishing off my college, and then going back onto the rigs to get enough money to even start racing. So I was determined, even after that first adventure onto the track, to say, this is everything. I know this has got everything inside me that I want to do. Yeah. I love the speed. I love controlling stuff. I love cars. I love the power and the precision. And I thought, I want to get better at this. And you had to remember all that when you was hanging from a piece of scaffold 150 foot above the ocean.
Good motivation for you, seriously.
Because it's you spend that long out there in freezing cold weather and you've got to remember what it's all about. Mm. I'm out here to get the money together to go motor racing. And you did need that kind of motivation to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously you had no previous karting experience or anything like that, like everyone seems to do today. Did that hinder you, do you think?
Sure. Because, you know, when I came in, I was very quick, but I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I mean,
the racecraft.
Well, not even that. Even on my own, I was quite capable of smashing it into a wall because I've just gone too far, taken too many risks without the appropriate amount of talent or experience to keep it on the road. So you make a big mistake. I wasn't clear how to get it back. And the thing that stopped me quite often was the wall. Yeah. So, you know, that was...
Not ideal.
Yeah. I mean, I used to be 6'2" before the accident.
But I suppose you learn quickly that way, don't you?
You do, but it's also incredibly expensive because it burnt through my Ulrich money inside six races of 1982. So I'd set three pole positions from off the street.
1982?
Yeah.
I was 1 year old. You weren't even born.
I won't even say that, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it's amazing how time moves past because I remember at like 21, 22 years old, if I was looking at somebody who's 58, I'd think, yeah, and you're still alive.
Yeah.
You know? Always good to see you in the morning. You survived another night.
Yes.
You know?
You're reading my mind, Perry. How are you doing that?
Exactly. But that was the journey. And it was certainly that was the beginning of it. And I knew that it was going to take more and more money. So even while I was racing, I was walking around industrial estates, knocking on doors, trying to chat the secretary up to get to meet a director or owner of a company or whatever to convince them that their company has been lucky to survive without backing me. And occasionally it worked. And a few people would give me a couple of bob to keep going, keep holding on. Mm. But I knew that having done my six races, that the following year, you know, I had to do something fairly special because it's no good being good. You've got to do something special. And when you've got no money, you've got to get noticed. So I did go out, and luckily enough, I did win the championship in 1983. So that was a big flag-waving exercise. And I would say even people inside F1 were, you know, kind of taking a bit of notice of me, probably because I had a big mouth as well, but people could see that, you know, I was pretty damn determined.
Yeah.
And so that was great to start making some friends, even at that stage in F1. But again, the problem was there was no money to progress properly for the following year. And in fact, you know, I was, I think it was the second race of 1984. I had a massive accident in Formula Ford, which broke my back.
Oh,
and
gosh.
That put me out for a whole bunch of months. No money, you got to recover from that. And then going back in 85, still in Formula Ford. And I didn't even want to do it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, what was your mentality after that?
The mentality was this year on 2 6 of a budget in 1985. And it showed. Mm. It really did. Because we were against a whole bunch of really great drivers.
This is all funded by you knocking on doors, talking to different sponsors.
Well, totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And I also managed to get the vote for what was back then a little scheme called Racing for Britain.
Yeah.
But our budget, we were running on stupid, stupid money. We were running on like £14,000 or £15,000 for the year.
Yeah.
We couldn't test, couldn't have the engine rebuilt, la di da di da. Yeah, it sounds like a load of excuses, but it's you can't give that advantage away to these other guys and expect to be on their pace.
Did you, this is something I actually came up with Kelvin on the last podcast, was in terms of budget, knowing that your funds were so limited, did that affect the way that you drove? Did you think, if I put this in the wall, what am I going to do?
No. When I was getting in the car, I was giving it whatever I had. But I was finding, and you don't often hear me say this, in fact, this is the only time I've ever been really, really demoralised, is that I just did not want to be racing Formula Ford that year. And I think a combination of circumstances, lack of budget, and also, you know, heart not completely in it. But there was never any time when I was backing out of anything because I was scared of that damaging the car and money. It did happen, and we ended up at the end of the season, I had to find another £5,000 from accident damage.
Yeah.
You know, which a mate of mine who had recently got banned from driving, he had had to sell his car. He lent me all the money. That's all the money he had in the entire world. And he lent me that with the hope that I would be going Formula 3 with a proper budget the following year.
Yeah.
And then, lo and behold, bang, I did it. I managed to bring a major sponsor to go Formula 3. And with all the other personal backing, I gave him his money back and bought him a holiday in Austria for him and his
girlfriend.
Amazing,
amazing. So that was that your sort of turning point in your younger career?
Totally, yeah.
Where you thought, right, I've got this sponsor now, time to really make this serious.
Well, I mean, it was, I was quite pleased about winning the Formula 4 Championship with such little racing behind
me. How old were you at this point?
22.
So you've got a strong head on you as well to keep your mindset like that.
But to me, there was no other choice. Is that I've now said I'm going to get to Formula 1. And I know that sounds now being my age, looking back at that bloke who was saying it, you'd look at him now and say, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
The odds are against that, of getting to F1 with no money, no backing, no family money, all that kind of stuff. You're an idiot. It's never, ever going to happen. But that's where it's great to be an idiot sometimes, because, you know, you just keep charging after everything and just keep trying to find a way. So getting into Formula 3 was fantastic. Right back to the front immediately, which is great. And you keep making a mark. And then you're holding on for dear life, trying to get to Formula 3000. Then I went off to America. And again, each of those times, by the time I got to Formula 3000, the economy had collapsed. And I'd done quite well in property from good money that I'd earned in Formula 3. So basically, I signed the house over to Route to get that drive to go in Formula 3000 for just three races.
Wow.
That cost us the house.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? But who cares?
Yeah.
It's whatever it takes.
Yeah.
You know?
Sacrifice.
And I still believed I could get to Formula 1.
At what point did the Formula 1 teams come knocking? Because you've tested with various teams in the 90s. When did they sit up and take notice and think, let's get this guy in a car?
I guess it started getting real serious when I joined the Route Formula 3000 team. Now, the Route was, unfortunately, seriously off the pace. Most people weren't qualifying the car. So I was with the works car with Ron Toranac, the legendary Ron Toranac. And I kept putting it on the grid. Now, sure, I was only putting it on the grid like 14th or 15th or something like that. But the others weren't even qualifying. So it was showing Ron something like that, because my teammate was about, goodness, an awful lot slower, you know? Yeah. And so inside you're going, well, look, I can't win the race, but I'm winning my own battle by being considerably faster than the teammate. That's something as a race driver you've got to do. You're not always in a great car with a great team, but if you can show something in your surroundings, that's your opportunity to shine. So this is the optimist in me. You've got to hold on to something that can be good and fight for that. So for me, qualifying 15th was like putting it on pole.
Yeah.
When you've just totaled your teammate. Because that's showing the team, hey, there's nothing left to come. This bloke's on the edge.
Yeah.
So Ron, behind my back, actually was chatting Ken Tyrrell up about putting me into Tyrrell. And that got really close to happening. Ken had me down there. But then suddenly, there was a thing with Michele Alboreto going on about cigarette sponsorship. Michele was backed by Marlboro, and I think the team then got Camel. So Michele, it's all in my book, Flat Out, Flat Broke.
Yeah. Plug.
Normally $9.99, published by Haynes, available in a good
book. I can see a couple of copies over there.
Copies here.
Yeah, no, it's going really well. We sold another copy just last month.
just the single, yeah.
Thank you, yeah. He still keeps in contact. But it's, so there was this chance, but it was for two Grand Prix with Tyrrell. But Johnny, who'd recently been laid off by Benetton earlier that year, then suddenly Ken chose to bring Johnny back. And look, you know, crikey, I can't argue with that.
Yeah.
I think the world of Johnny. He's a brilliant racing driver. But it was just those moments in time where you're just about to step into a Tyrrell. And yeah, I'm not unique in this. There's been a lot of other drivers who've been exactly that same point. But you go, ah, damn it. Okay, but if it can happen that close, then maybe it can happen again.
Yeah.
So you know that you're on the radar from what you're doing. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah,
I can't remember what the question was, but that was the answer.
Well, I like it. And then Williams F1 team, Arrows, Benetton.
Well, the States was before all that.
And how did it go out there?
Brilliantly. Yeah, I got really lucky. That's Roger Cowman, who I'd just finished driving for in Formula 3000. And, you know, from no testing, borrowed tyres, everything else against a Lacy, Comas, Bernard Irvine, etc.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were kind of, we were right. We were pushing them for just the few races that we had. So that was super. And it was because of that, then there was an opportunity to go IMSA in America.
Yeah.
And Roger knew a guy called Julian Randles, and Julian used to be the team manager of the Theodore Formula One team. And Julian was running Spice USA. So Spice is a chassis. We had the Chevrolet engines. The team was running on $300,000, and we were against the Works Jaguar, the Works Nissan, the Works Toyota, Works Porsche teams, who were on squillions. And I could go faster than them. We wouldn't last, though. That's the problem. But I knew that this is a chance to wave the flag again.
Yep.
To say, if I can keep doing a David and Goliath on this, keep putting the car right at the front in qualifying at least, to show, look guys, I can do this, please. Have a look, you know? Then it was advertising.
Yeah.
And the boys back here on the press, the UK press, they've always been, you know, people like David Tremaine especially, Joe Saywood and Simon Aaron, and you keep going through this long list, Alan Henry, all the very well-known journalists were always trying to push my cause, trying to create a bit of attention. So they used everything I was doing in America to keep waving the flag, saying Perry's doing
the
this.
The Brit abroad, yeah.
That's right, doing and having thing. A chat with people in F1.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, when that half chance came up with Formula One with Andrea Moda, I was the name in the frame.
Yeah.
So that's how it happened. So nobody ever does anything totally by themselves. And it's so wonderful when people do kind of latch on to what you're about and believe in you, because that means so much. When you've just lost the house, when you're in hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of debt, when you haven't got a regular drive, you're not getting paid, you're having to find a way to survive every week, and then go and take these guys on top of that. No manager, no trainer, no special dietitian. You know, it's all about you and having the heart to do it. And I don't mean to sound big-headed. This isn't pity poor eyes and I haven't got the violin out. I'm just completely telling you what the deal was and what it was like. But I must tell you that by the time I got on track, and we had a little chat off air earlier about hunger, I was chewing through the steering wheel by the time I was on track.
And
that hunger, I've still got it. For whatever deal I'm into or for whatever I'm doing, I can't take second best.
Yeah.
Or I'm not about to set out.
It's in you.
It is in me.
And I think today, you know, that hunger is there or not there more so than it has been through the years, with the likes of big pay drivers coming in and perhaps replacing some of the title sponsors who have faded away a little bit. And you've got these guys coming in with horrendously deep pockets or deep-pocketed parents who will literally buy their way into a Formula One team. And they perhaps don't have that innate drive and hunger to really make it to the top of the sport.
It's, you know...
Do you have a strong opinion on the whole pay driver label, or is it sort of something that's part and parcel and has been a part of, you know, motorsport for years, really?
I think
it's how it works.
It's been part of motorsport for years. Yeah. And, you know, even the drivers that one might term pay drivers or label them, I mean, these guys are still sitting in those bloody things, you know?
Yeah.
These Formula One cars are unbelievably fast. So, you know, they're not complete donuts, you know? and as one of them in particular shows, it's quite enigmatic in a way, is that suddenly you'll turn in some really good performances, and then other times you don't even know he's out there. But that can apply to a few people, to be honest. So it's like the truth will out in the end, is that if they've been given the opportunity, great, take it, squeeze it. I would, you know, if my parents were unbelievably rich, I'd be doing the garden at the weekend, shining their shoes, anything. Tell them how much I love them, how good looking they are, and how funny and intelligent they are. Whatever it took. Here's your name on the side of the car.
You could go racing. Yeah.
I can be a loving son proportional to budget. So it could have, you know, whatever it takes, they've got the opportunity. Squeeze it. That's great. Get in the car. But then you've got to deliver.
Yeah.
You know, and it is difficult because I've got one quality that I believe I've got in life. So hopefully this qualifies anything I say. I have never, ever been jealous of anybody, ever. I've got plenty of faults, believe me, but I'm not jealous of anybody. I'm not jealous of anybody from what they've achieved. I admire people. I absolutely do. I think fantastic, that's it. But even when I used to lose a race, I actually used to go to the bottom of the podium and look at the guys standing up there and just go, well done, boys. Well done. It didn't stop me thinking, but I want to be standing where you are.
Yeah.
You know? But I'd always go and applaud and say, well done.
Yeah. That's a good trait. Great trait.
Mm. Well, it is true. So when I'm talking about the well-heeled drivers that we're discussing, there's no spite or bitterness. It's just a question of saying, okay, fine. You've got the chance. I'm the one to advocate.
Yeah.
Get the parents' money. But you've got to deliver.
Yeah.
You've got to deliver, and you've got to show that heart.
Well, I think that's half the problem with some of these drivers. I mean, okay, you know, let's not beat around the bush. There's people like Lance Stroll, okay, who's probably everyone's favourite example, who sometimes just does not look interested. You know, he just sometimes just disappears into the back of the pack and doesn't want to be there, doesn't put his foot through the floor, and just, you think, come on, you know, what an opportunity. You're a Formula One racing driver. Pull your finger out.
Yeah, well, when you look at drivers like that, I want to ask, how do you have your mentality that you have now? Have you always had that since you first started? Because, you know, look at Lance Stroll. He's a very young guy. You could probably blame a lot of his stuff being on youth and, you know, ignorance, perhaps. Have you always had that mentality? Cause it's quite impressive to have that when you're first starting at the age of 22.
So what mentality?
Sorry. So just being not jealous for anything, being focused on yourself and totally being focused able to on myself.
I mean, this is why I'm motor racing. Yeah. To be completely honest, there weren't many drivers that worried me as far as their talent was concerned, because there were certain people that I definitely had an eye on, thinking, wow, you're good, you know, really good. I mean, Johnny comes to mind, to be quite honest, and Alesi, you know, and you think, wow. Mm. But at the end of the day, it didn't matter what they did, because it's about me. Mm. It's the, if I'm worried about them, I've got to work harder. I've got to go faster than them.
Yeah.
So, you know, having anything saying, oh, it's all right for you, you're in a better car, a better team, it doesn't matter.
Well, it's
a
waste of energy as well.
Yeah, it's a waste of energy.
That's another stress you don't need.
It doesn't change my position. All I can do is concentrate on me, trying to make me as good as I can be.
Yeah.
And let the others get on with it, you know?
Yeah.
And I must admit, you know, certainly back then, there were so many times racing wheel to wheel with these guys, is that, you know, it was always hard racing. But one thing I don't remember is all this weaving all over the place. You know, it was just, there was a bit more of a respect. Anyway, I've probably gone slightly off the
point. That's right, I don't mind a tangent. So you mean, what, weaving under...
As in defending when defending? Or
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're not going to weave if you're out in the lead just for a laugh, are you?
Well, you never know. Warm up the tyres a little bit. Maybe if you've got a real advantage, may as well. That's what I do. Maybe that's why I'm not a racing driver.
Yeah.
You're just
trying to be a bit more interesting for the TV to get the sponsors.
Sometimes you look at Hamilton going out, and you go, oh, spice it up a bit.
Yeah.
So you're not impressed with the current state of Formula One, are you? Or
look, there's so much about Formula One I absolutely love.
Yeah.
I really do, and I'm still into it. And sure, we're going to get the occasional race that's a little bit processional. That was always the way. But there are absolutely certain things in Formula One that I've been advocating particular changes for a real long time. Now, I'm not exactly expecting Liberty Media or Formula One itself to jump up and say, well, Perry said, you know, but, you know, certain other people, there are some extremes that I've got, is that I'm rather hoping your listening audience is fairly up to speed on aerodynamics. So, you know, one of the big problems about following a car is the air disturbance of the car in front. So these Formula One cars, a top-level race car, is pretty much about the management of air. It's the management of air around it, the management of air over it, the management of air under it, and the management of air through it, of course, the cooling. And where all that air starts is on the front wings.
Yep.
And the development and the sophistication of the front wings is absolutely incredible. But so is their cost.
Yep.
So if we've got this front wing system that's creating this state-of-the-art, work-of-art thing of beauty in the corners on its own to just go really, really fast, but then gets completely messed up as soon as it starts following another car, let's get rid of the front wings.
Yeah. Or make them spec.
Well, just get rid of the front wings. You know, because we've got too much that I don't think you can ever go back to spec anymore. That nobody's going to have that. So just get rid of the front wings. You know, then at least from the actual very front of the car, there's not that much of a performance change.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure, they'll find another way to help it out with barge balls, etc. But get rid of the front wings.
Yeah.
What about your issues with Formula One that you've encountered with in the past? If we go back to your career, we were in America. What was the next progression after that? You went back to the UK for some Formula One?
Yeah, well, I mean, after the States, you know, everything I was doing in the States was to get the attention, because that's what it's about. You know, if you want to be a Formula One driver, you've got to get attention. And that's with, you know, your speed or your results or both. So in principle, that worked. But it's the old adage, be careful what you wish for, you might just get it. Because
welcome, Andrew Moda.
That's the thing. So I thought, you know, cock-a-hoop, you know, champagne corks, etc. Again, I've been accepted into Formula One. I thought it was going to be a fight. But that's one of the reasons that I got the drive. They said they want somebody who's just not going to moan and complain. He's just going to bite through the steering wheel, as I said, and do everything possible with this tiny little team, this black beast. Well, we couldn't do anything with it.
No.
I mean, this thing...
When did you realise that right from the off?
Right from the off. Yeah. I mean, this thing was... It was all black, you know? And this wasn't just slow. It was dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, what we should have done is just had brass handles put on the side to save time. Because when it killed me, it just lowered me down into a 6 foot steel in it. It was the right colour.
And you had some really genuinely scary experiences with this team.
When I saw them, I couldn't believe them. It felt like something you'd write in a film script or something like that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just... It's, you know, there should be a new book, How to Kill Your Driver.
Because,
as I say, we weren't just the slowest car out there, but we were easily the most dangerous, you know? So, but you're trapped as a race driver. I mean, Bernie paid me a big compliment once. He said, he's a brave little bastard. I wouldn't get in that thing sitting in a pit lane. Which I said to him afterwards, thanks for that, Bernie. That's great. But, you know, you're desperate. You're a racer. And I'm going to try and drag this thing around. But, you know, when they're putting components on the car that they knew weren't working and the steering wheel fails in the middle of Eau Rouge at Belgium... Even a slow car's pulling 180 miles an hour there.
What's the worst place on the planet you could possibly have that kind of thing happen?
There's a few things that, you know, there's a bunch of permutations that aren't great for a race driver, but that's certainly one of them.
What about the wet tire, dry track situation?
Again, that was insane.
How someone could be in their right mind and send you out like that?
Yeah, there were a bunch of people trying to work that one out, Harry, honestly. So they sent me out on what was virtually a dry track on wet tires. By then I'd had enough. I went out, the first lap I did, I was actually joint fastest. Yeah, but the second lap, the tires were falling apart.
Yeah.
I stayed flat coming over the start finish line on the grass, and I was changing up because I didn't care anymore. I thought, I'm going to smash this thing to pieces. And then I got really lucky. On the next lap, the clutch failed, which meant I couldn't do anything anymore because my head had gone a bit by then, just going, I'm going to start doing things here which is going to really get me hurt.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I had a t-shirt made up by then. I designed it. It said, let Pell out. Because it was a fake protest t-shirt because I was being put on the circuit for so little time.
Yeah.
So is this around the time that you started to be coined the world's unluckiest racing driver?
Well, yeah, I think so. But also, there were a whole bunch of races that I'd led. I mean, there were like 5 Formula 3 races that I'd led or was challenging for lead when the car went wrong. You know? Formula 3000? No, probably wasn't unlucky in Formula 3000, but in the States... Again, from the amount of races that I did in the States, led an awful lot of them. And I'm not hard on a car.
Yeah.
But, you know, if there's no engine rebuilds and if there's no testing, something's going to break.
Yeah.
So we'd be leading. It was like the Daytona 24 hours. With 2 hours to go, was 3 laps in the lead from the Works Ferrari team. 2 hours to go. And then the engine went. And you just look up and you go, oh, give me a break.
And your mental state. So you get to Formula One. You think
you could probably just leave it as that, Tim. Your mental state.
Yeah. Or your mental.
Yeah, that's it.
Full stop.
End of story. Where's my sandwiches?
So you get to Formula One, and then that's box ticked from ever since you first started, isn't it?
And then falls apart with Andrew Moda. And you, I mean, what did you think? Is it like this is it? This is the end of the road for me?
Well, not just that, but you know, I kind of, I got to Formula One because I thought I was incredibly fast, and if you don't think that, you've got no right being in a race car, you know. A lot of other people did as well, so it was actually embarrassing, you know. I was walking through a paddock like the mutt of the pit lane.
Yeah,
I'd come from being Flash Harry in the States to like Muttley at the end of the pit lane in Formula One. It's, you
horrible,
know,
horrible, I just felt experience.
You know, it's, I felt quite literally embarrassed to look at certain drivers in the eye, thinking, yeah, you must think I'm useless. This is how it's, because honestly, people don't have time to go through, you know, all your ins and outs and the problems you're facing. It's just black and white. You look like an idiot. You look so bad.
Did that affect any potential offerings from other teams in the pit lane when you were looking out for maybe other drives?
There was, I mean, fortunately enough, I was offered a couple of drives for the following season, but they needed me to bring a little bit, not massive, but just a little bit of sponsorship. Well, I had got the Andrea Moda drive without bringing any sponsorship. I wasn't getting paid, and I had to find my own expenses to even get to the races, but at least I didn't have to find money to get into Formula One. Mm. But these other teams, you know, you're talking about things like LaRusse, maybe Tyrrell, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they needed, I don't know, 400 or 500,000 quid. I didn't have it. We had no house left anymore. And so it just wasn't going to happen. I couldn't make it happen to get in a proper car.
And was that the end of Andrea Moda and Andrea Sassetti? Was that they left Formula One presumably when they ended up being booted out essentially by the FIA, and that was,
yeah, they were
done,
told to run two cars correctly, because, you know, my teammate was a Brazilian driver called Roberto Moreno. Now Roberto is like a proven, you know, driver, is very, very good indeed, and they couldn't run him properly. And that's where all the efforts were going, let alone running me properly.
Did you ever get any kind of explanation at all for any of the things that happened?
I didn't need any explanation. It was quite clear they didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, they made shoes, didn't they? That was their business.
You know
business.
What? I'm not clear that's where their money came from, because I tried a pair on once and thought, nobody's going to be buying these.
No good. Fancy schmancy Italian shoes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So what followed? You've finished your F1 career with possibly the worst F1 team in history.
That was it. There was one chance, and it was with Williams to become their test driver. But there was a bloke called David, what's his surname? Cool something. Yeah.
Never heard of him.
No, neither have I.
Don't know who you're talking
about. I think
he
made it. No.
So it was between me and Dave, and the team made the decision to go with David. When I wrote a copy of my book, I can't tell you exactly what I put on the inside cover, but I sent Dave a copy saying, thanks for my career, you lots of love, Pell. Right? So he said he keeps it by his bedside table to remind him how it could have all gone wrong. Yeah. When he wrote a copy of his book, he sent me one through the post. I've opened it out and said, dear Pell, I owe it all to you. Thanks so much. Love, Dave. Which I thought was cool. But, you know, it's, again, going back to that jealousy thing, is that there was that moment in time, I think Dave had already had a lot of things going on inside Williams. And if he has, that's the deal. Use them. Strangle them. Do whatever it takes to get that drive. And that's what happened. Yeah. David got that drive. Plus the fact David was a lot younger than me. I don't know if he was faster. I don't really know. Whatever. Let's park that one. So Williams obviously thought, hey, listen, this guy's on the way up. You know, where's Perry anyway? So from Williams' position, totally understand. It didn't feel as if I got a fair crack at a whip of it. But that's life. But it was immediately after the Williams thing, we were in so much trouble at home. You know, as I say, you know, no house, massive debts, etc. And I had to down tools and just start going out and getting involved in trading, whatever it was, buying and selling stuff and trying to earn a living for the family for the next couple of years.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we were finished.
So where did that money come from to live for the next few years?
Oh, I'm bloody good at spotting deals. Yeah, I had a friend of mine who was, yeah, absolutely hustling. He was in reclaimed furniture, so I'd do this. That went into office supplies.
Oh, wow.
I'd find a package, find somebody to buy it, all that. Get in the middle of stuff, up it. Even went to welding rods, I remember, you know. So, yeah, I told you I was a bright spark. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
So it carried on like that. And then suddenly Richard Lloyd phoned up and said he wanted to look at me for joining the Audi British Touring Car Championship team.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, great. You know, because Richard had run me for a race with Porsche in the Mexico Round of the World Endurance Championship. So then he said, okay, I've been waiting for an opportunity. That's it. Audi, da da da. Then suddenly that didn't happen. But it had whetted my appetite now to get back in and come back on. And I managed to put a deal together with Lotus to come back in the GT World Championship, partnering with Jan Lammers.
Right.
So that got me back on the way then. Then I joined Chrysler as one of their first works drivers for Le Mans. And then all that brought me to the attention of panels. And I signed with Dave Brabham to be with the panels team, and also Andy Wallace and James Weaver. And Andy Wallace was one of the instrumental people in getting me that drive there. My old Formula 3 team, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
Great, great guy, Andy. And he really backed me up.
Yeah.
You know, he was in a position to, and he did. So that got me right back on it. And then, of course, just a little while later, joined Audi properly for their incumbent season into World Sports Cars.
Right.
You know, Le Mans, Sebring. So that really started bringing me back through. But, and thank goodness, you know, as from, you know, panels, etc., I started getting paid, you know, very well indeed.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were bailing out that sunk ship when we had risen.
Yeah, yeah. There must have been a huge relief after that, you know, a few years of turmoil.
It was tricky, you know, and you know, you do have moments where you're thinking it's all crashed and burned. You know, it's all fallen apart. But you can't sit there and be depressed.
No.
You can't. Well, you can, but you're gonna go nowhere if you are. Yeah, you know, I don't have the luxury, or didn't have the luxury, of having enough money to be depressed.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sorry, there's no spurge on mental health issues here. But I'm just talking about from my own situation, is that even though certain parts of me felt like wrapping up in a ball, you know, because I was so hurt by what had happened in Formula 1, I was not going to let people see that. But, you know, I was passionate about this game. It had taken everything and a lot more than most people put in. So for it to end so badly was a little bit, it felt cruel. Now, in life out there, when we look at the plight of many poor people, in relation to their plight, it's nothing.
It's all relative, though, isn't it?
But for me, at that moment in time, my own hopes, dreams, and aspirations, you're going, goodness.
Yeah.
But you do need to keep a balance. You need to realise that there is life after understeer, you know? and there's, if you're determined enough, there's maybe a way back. And that is what I will say to everybody who's in a dark situation.
There is a way back. Do you talk about much of this in your book, Flat Out, Flat Broke? What's in the book?
I talk about how I feel, but I don't get profound about it.
Right.
I was probably getting slightly profound then, but I just...
I liked it.
But I am kind of
profound, Perry.
I am passionate about this. That, you know, I meet so many people say, oh yeah, I could have been a racing driver. Why won't you? Oh, well, it's all about the money. Well, okay, fine.
Yeah.
But I used to spend... People used to laugh that I was spending 4 or 5 hours a day walking around industrial estates, knocking on doors, making phone calls, sending letters out, just not giving up.
Mm.
So, it was about the money. That's why I went a race driver. Oh, well, maybe there'd been a couple more barriers where it didn't work for you, where you couldn't fight through that.
Yeah.
Become there. I tell you one thing. There are an awful lot of people who race cars. There are very few racing drivers. And I believe that that's all wrapped up in this attitude.
Yeah.
You know?
No, I'm totally with you. I mean, in a previous life, I was a racing driver manager, and I dealt with a lot of young drivers, some incredibly good, some thriving today. Jamie Chadwick, one of them, who's doing an incredible job in the W Series, and looked after a lot of young drivers, and some of them had that drive, and some of them didn't. It's just in them or it wasn't, and you can't necessarily teach that kind of drive. You know, it's there or it isn't. Listen, we could talk Formula One all day, but there are some other bits we want to touch on.
Yeah, sure.
Stiggy, let's talk Stig.
So yeah, Top Gear comes calling.
Top Gear. How?
It was one of those things about timing. You know, you're saying about the world's unluckiest racing driver. Well, unfortunately, there were quite a lot of things that support that a little bit. However, I was terribly lucky with the whole Top Gear thing, because I'd written a book about all my ups and downs, and you know, as you know, it's everybody said, look, Perry, all the stunts and the disasters and the way you've got out of it, and you've got to write this book. So I did, and we had this great party, a real brilliant book launch at the Audi showrooms in Green Park in London. And we had a lot of friends there from Formula One and some from TV and stuff like that. And Jeremy, I'd known Jeremy for a while anyway. So Jeremy was there and pretty much took me to one side afterwards and said, hey, listen, Top Gear had been off air for a long time by then. He said, look, we're bringing Top Gear back and we want to put an idea past you and stuff like that. And it ended up being, you know, you're going to be this secret, mean, moody race driver dressed in black, because of course Stig was in black.
Yeah.
First off, so you're going to wear black boots, black overalls, black gloves, black crash helmet, black visor, and we're going to call you the Gimp.
No, they didn't.
I said, no, you're not.
No.
Yeah. And they were real serious. And I said, no, we're not doing that one. No, it's going to come out one day, and I'm not going to walk down the street being known as the Gimp.
Yeah, no. You know?
So finally, that's when it ended up as being the Stig. But yeah, there was something that was pretty funny actually, is that talking to them and they said, okay, you've got to keep it quiet. I said, yeah, well, I understand. Yeah, top secret. I said, yeah, I won't tell anybody. I said, well, I'm going to have to tell the wife. They said, no, you can't tell the wife. So I said, no, trust me, I'm going to have to tell the wife. They said, no, you can't tell the wife. I said, no, boys, trust me, I'm going to have to tell the wife. And they said, why? I said, listen, you try leaving the house 6 o'clock in the morning just for Metaphor in black leather. Saying, don't worry, darling, I should be home around midnight, but nothing's going on. Yeah. I said, I see your point. You can tell the wife. Thanks.
Well, off that, we've had some questions that have come in from various people on social media. So I'm going to chuck a few at you. So on that note, was it hard to keep the secret of the Stig? That's from Becky.
Yeah, it was, actually.
Yeah. Because you want to shout about it a little bit, don't you?
I know, because it was a really exciting thing to happen. When you see it on TV and you're going, no, I'm Top Gear, and everybody's going, who's the Stig? Who's the Stig? I mean, I'd be down the pub and I could hear people saying, who do you reckon the Stig is? And I think, well, you're standing next to him, actually.
Yeah.
You know? But I never said anything. Not even for free lager, I didn't give it away. But but it was quite exciting. A couple people did guess immediately inside my
room. There's always rumours, aren't there?
It was me, yeah. Because I've got bandy legs and I always used to stand with my arms folded because I had cool to be upset enough at racetracks, so people kind of used to me standing there with my arms folded.
Like the one we've got here on the
absolutely
front of the
bike, yeah. So
brilliant.
It was tough because it was so exciting to everybody, yeah. And you're thinking, wow, I'm right at the center of this. But I didn't publicize it. I didn't say anything, and that was it. So no, I didn't. I'd shaken hands, so yeah. I don't give the game away if I shake hands.
Okay. Billy has asked, what does the inside of the suit smell like?
Which that's not really suit? Come from Mark Blundell, is it? Because Billy is his nickname. Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah,
but, that and how many different helmets were there?
Oh, and, what is the inside of the Stig suit?
Yeah.
It's
not going to be pretty.
Tell Billy that I do actually shower every day. and also wash the overalls. So no, that was no problem. And I only had one crash helmet.
Okay.
Yeah.
Eleanor has asked, are any of the... They must have done this in the first season, because I can't remember. When they introduce you in the studio, they go, Jeremy Clarkson would always go, some say, were any of those stories ever true? Did you have any say over that? Or was it... Or you were quite a separate entity almost to that side of things?
That's totally down to Jeremy's imagination. Yeah. And he did come up with a few cool guys,
didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, on that, who was your favourite Top Gear presenter? Emma's asked that one.
You know, so this isn't politically correct. I actually liked all three of them and still do it. Yeah. There's no side. I think that they are, you know, I think James has been a revelation because the others had kind of media backgrounds before, whereas James May didn't have so much. And James is...
He was more of a journalist, right? Wasn't he?
More of a journalist. Yeah. But they are... All three are super TV presenters, but they're also each very good writers. And that's one of the things that they've got. It's not just being on stage saying something dumb. You know, it's what they're saying is either informative or entertaining or both. And then that kind of relationship the three had on the Top Gear stuff kept us entertained as viewers. So, but seriously, no, absolutely no favourite. I like them all, and I think they do I think they're all really talented guys, actually. Yeah. Really
and just a final couple of stick questions from Emma again. So when your time came
to an end being the Stig. Did you have any say over who the next Stig was? Did you have to do any training with them?
No, my time came to an end quite literally, because I'd been racing for Audi, and you know, commercially speaking, that was apart from being so enjoyable to be with Audi, commercially it was very good. And I was training, I was testing, I was traveling, etc. We'd found how big Top Gear had become as a commercial success across the world. We found exactly how big Stig had become, and I did quite rightly feel that I brought some stuff to the party as Stiggy on Harry behaved, because they wasn't going to have him so snotty before, you know, because I just used to turn around and walk off when somebody was speaking, because that was me just saying, these are all the things a race driver really wants to do. They just wants to drive, you know. But the Stig could do that. It didn't have to be sociable. It didn't have to have a personality. It could just revert back into this prehistoric driver thing, you know. I definitely had loads of fun with that. But when it came time to renegotiate, because I'd said, okay, I'd continue for the second season. I said, but, you know, we really need to talk about where I'm going to be going in the future, guys. And we got to that point, and they wanted me to sign on the same terms as I had been on. And I said, I don't want to do that. I said, you know, we need to seriously up the ante. And they didn't want to do that. So I said, okay, we'll see you later. And they said, okay, bye. But that was fine. You know, it's like, you know, they didn't want to pay me any more for being on there. That's their prerogative.
Yeah.
But it's equally my prerogative to say, listen, I'm a racing driver. There's only so much of going around and around in family road cars or even supercars that I'm worried about. Because, you know, I'm not racing anybody. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I was always trying, but that wasn't my core being.
Yeah.
So I was quite happy to leave it alone.
Yeah. And then Ben Collins, wasn't it, that went on? Was it Ben Collins
after?
Was he straight
after? I can't remember.
Yeah, he was there for a while. Came in as White Stig.
Yeah.
Well, and then IBS was White Stig.
I won't give away the hand signal that's being portrayed as we speak.
Well, that's all. Thank you for the questions on the Stig. I hope
we've
they've
got,
all
got
answered.
Loads of them.
Yeah, there were quite a few. Oh, and Richard, do you still live in Essex?
Yes, I do.
There we go. Essex boy, through and through.
Okay, I've got one for you. Not Stig related. What are you rubbish at?
Putting up with bad manners.
Good one.
Yeah. As I said earlier, I've got a whole bunch of faults. So I'm pretty intolerant. I try to be tolerant, but I guess my level of intolerance kicks in a lot faster.
Are you one of those people like me who, if you walk past or if you drive past someone who, for example, throws a sweet wrapper on the floor, you have to stop, get out of the car and tell them to pick it up?
Yeah, it's around my way. You might get stabbed doing that, but no, I'm joking. I just feel that there's a way to go about life, and I just appreciate people being mannered and considerate. Don't have to agree with you on stuff, or and vice versa, but you know, I'm intolerant of bad manners. I'm also intolerant of people who take forever on a deal, on a business deal or something like that. I think, get some balls.
Yeah,
you know, for God's sake, grow some, take a risk, throw the dice, or just step out and say no.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, with my career, believe me, I understand no in 37 different languages.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's nice to hear it rather than being dragged through a sponsorship thing or another presentation or whatever, and you're just going, for completely. Goodness sake,
yeah,
come on.
Yeah,
you know, I think that for me, that a lot of this is my fault, that one of the things that kind of suited me about motor racing was that it was so intense, that it was just flat out, you're doing this, you're doing that, and it's now, and still, after all these years, I can't quite get my head around how slow so many people are, or departments are, or companies are, and what they have to go through to consider. And just so, you know, it is part of life. But I find that still incredibly difficult.
Rubs you up the wrong
way. And I do everything I can to try and short circuit that and try and make sure that people can come to get a decision going. But it's this mediocrity. I understand failure. Believe me, I've failed, sadly, so many times on so many different things. Luckily enough, I have had a whole bunch of success. But you won't find me in the middle, because I've got no time for mediocrity. And I guarantee you, all my friends are not mediocre. They might have failed as well, or they might be highly successful, but they're not mediocre. And that's how I look at stuff.
Couple more for you. I know we're tight on time, so I'll whiz through these. If you could give yourself a score from 1 through 10, but you cannot use the number 7, how weird are you? I think all racing drivers are a bit weird.
It's a good question. I think that I don't know. It's really cranky. I'd never thought of it like that. I guess that I just think that the weirdness. I don't know. I think that
if you could use the number 7, would you have that?
I think that it appears weird to people on how completely straight I am about the level of determination and what I want and how I see things and when I want them. And that's for everybody's benefit, not for mine. So maybe people think that's weird, or they're feeling maybe weird is a word that I don't know if I can mix that into this. I don't know if, you know, probably I'm weird. The weirdest I felt is trying to describe how weird I am. Okay. Are you sure number 7 is still taken?
Yes.
I don't know. I can't answer the question. I think
you've more than answered it actually with that. Yeah. So
okay, I've got 3 more for 7. You. Got 3 more for you. It's a 7. I've got 3 more for you. What's got you excited at the moment?
Returning to racing. Yeah. Well, do you know what? I nearly said what I was going to be coming in.
Nearly got him.
Yeah. No, this is going to be... Oh, I tell you, honest to God, I'm
excited about
this. Yeah, so am I. Yeah, I really am excited. And that's going to be great fun. And there's one giveaway I can tell you. It's going to start happening at the end of July.
End of July, okay. Yeah. Well, when it does happen, we'll come and meet you at a track. Perfect. And we'll talk about it there.
Yeah.
If not racing and all the public speaking that you do now, which you haven't even had a chance to get onto, but that's a whole other subject, another part of your life, the book, etc., what would you be doing?
Writing, probably.
Okay.
Yeah. I enjoy writing. And actually, a project that I have got coming up is that I'm going to be turning the book into an audio book.
Yeah.
I haven't done that quite yet because I'm trying to tie up a couple of marketing deals to make sure that when I do it, that it does have an impact.
Yeah.
Rather than wallowing into the ether. And that's a project that I'm looking forward to. I've always liked writing and the experiences and trying to, I guess I've always liked, ever since I was a kid, I've liked, it's just in me. I like trying to make people laugh, you know?
Oh.
It's Perry's phone from the 1960s. It's Karen Mobb.
Yep, that's the wife.
Shall I answer it?
Yes, please.
Karen? Hi, it's Tim here. We're just interviewing your husband. We're nearly done. It's okay. Do you want me to pass on a message? I will indeed. You're welcome. Okay, bye.
Could you call her back when you're done?
Yeah.
Lovely.
Final question for you. How much of your success is about luck and right place, right time, and how much is down to sheer hard work?
I mean, I think that the timing, you know, at the book launch with Jeremy being there and the Stiggy thing, that was, you know, I had no input on that. Except the fact that I'd written a book, except the fact that we'd had this party, and except the fact that Jeremy had been invited. So, you know, I was probably an easy solution for them. But there's no question about it. That was actually just good fortune. And they felt that I was the kind of bloke who could keep the secret. So, you know, as I say, I shake hands, and that's it. But generally, you know, I often wish there was a thing as just complete fluke and luck, and there is. But you can't budget on that. You can't look to a future that is just about luck. So unfortunately, I've found that it's about an awful lot of hard work and commitment and dedication and perseverance, and hopefully a bit of creativity, definitely a good bit of fun along the way, because it is blimmin' important to have fun along the way, because everything else is so serious.
Yep.
You know, so if it all crashes and burns, at least you've had that counterpoint of having had some great stories and great fun at the same time. So, yeah, I'm an advocate of saying hey, listen, it's, you know, whoever you are, it depends on what you want from life. If you're just happy to just let stuff drift by and just be in something where, okay, it pays the bills and that's fine, then that's fine. You're never going to know the disappointments and the sadness, but you're never going to know the real up times of succeeding, etc. So it's a question of personality, and it's a question about what you want from everything.
Yeah.
And I'm still out to have this big adventure, even at 58. Yeah. I really am.
Well, a new one is about to start for you. So.
It really is. So, yeah, it's about, you know, it's about work, getting on with it, but hopefully having a blooming good laugh along the way.
Brilliant. Brilliant. That's great. Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for chatting.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to episode 3 of the Motormouth podcast, and special thanks to Robin and the team at Right Formula for allowing us to record the podcast at their very fancy offices, and to Perry for giving up his time. We'll be back with another episode soon, but in the meantime, if you missed our first two episodes with racing driver and Fernando Alonso protege Callan O'Keefe and Emmerdale actor Kelvin Fletcher, you can listen back to those now. Like, subscribe and review if you feel so inclined, and we'll see you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.